morning. Thank you for attending this session. This is The Religion of Dieting, How Increasingly Secular Society is Embracing Dieting Dogma. This session will be recorded, and you'll be able to purchase it after the presentation downstairs if you would like. At the desk, you can also purchase other Sunstone merchandise with your tag here. We also encourage you to check out the bookstore in the center ballroom. Benchmark Books is good to us at Sunstone, and you can support them by purchasing a book or two. This session is 60 minutes long. We ask both the audience and the presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow the next session to proceed on a timely fashion. As a courtesy to other presenters, we ask that immediately after the session you clear the room and speak outside so that other presentations can begin. So this session, many people who are pursuing health believe that the only way to do it is to be restrictive and rigid with their eating. This talk will provide practical advice from a registered dietitian nutritionist about how to recognize dieting dogma in our culture and how to not let healthy eating become a religious all-or-nothing pursuit. Learning to love your body and not trying to manipulate it through diets is a radical act of self-care. Paige Smathers is a registered dietitian nutritionist in Salt Lake City who specializes in helping people heal their relationship with food. She also hosts the Nutrition Matters podcast. I will now turn the time over to Paige for her presentation.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming. And I've had such a great time at Sunstone so far, so I'm really honored to be here. I listen to a lot of Mormon podcasts, and I'm always thinking, like, when are they going to talk about food? And no one has. I'm like, really? Someone should do that. And then I thought, well, maybe it should be me. So here's my attempt and my stab at that, because I think it's a really fascinating topic, really applicable to everyone, no matter where you are in your Mormon journey, or what perspective you're coming from. The way we eat really, obviously, is an important thing to us. So just to introduce myself, I guess you already did. I never know how these things are going to go. So I have a little about me podcast that I publish about three episodes a month or so. And like Monica said, I specialize in helping people heal their relationship with food and their bodies. So that's a little bit about me. And I have two little kids, and I live here in Salt Lake City, so this is just like a 10-minute drive for me, no big deal. I feel really lucky. Okay, so there are certain topics that we just kind of know we need to avoid with our families, right? When we go and visit for Thanksgiving, it's like, okay, gear yourself up. We're not going to talk about religion. We're not going to talk about politics. We're just going to have a good time. I would actually also add nutrition to that list. If you have no idea what I'm talking about, if you're like, no, like, my family's fine. We can totally talk about nutrition, or it's not a big deal. Count yourself very lucky, because that's not normal. Well, it is normal, but it's not usual, I guess. Oh, and the other night, I was kind of laying awake in bed thinking about, wait, maybe there's more to it. Why do we struggle to talk about religion and politics and nutrition with our families? Like, what is it about? What's the common thread? Why is that so difficult? And what I came up with is we're really talking about bodies, right? When you're talking about nutrition, you're never just talking about carbohydrate, fat, and protein. You're talking about bodies, because people want to know what to eat because they want to manipulate their bodies, usually, right? Just the other day, yesterday, at Sunstone, I was in line for lunch, and the guy behind me found out I'm talking about nutrition today, and he said, "What do you think about protein?" Okay, do you have 3 hours? I don't really know what that question means. So, and really, I think the reason he was asking that question is because he really wanted to say, "Does protein make me ripped?" Right? And so when we're talking about nutrition, when we're asking questions about it, we're really talking about bodies. And I think we're talking about bodies in religion. We're talking about how to use your body, how to keep your body forever, how to be saved with your body, right? And with politics, we're also talking about bodies, governing bodies, so controlling bodies, telling people what to do and what not to do, and making rules that are necessary to keep society going. But I think what we're talking about is bodies, okay? So sometimes people get a little confused when me as a registered dietitian starts talking a lot about bodies and body image. I just say, well, how do you talk about nutrition without talking about that? That's really what people are talking about when they're asking you questions about nutrition, right? Okay, so I want to just say right out front, I really know that this is a sensitive subject. Like, I'm diving into two things on our list of, like, things to not discuss with people, right? So I feel like I'm being a touch brave here, but I want to set some intentions outright so that you understand where I'm coming from, what I'm trying to do, and what I'm not trying to do. So this is intended to teach ways of critically consuming media and nutrition science to avoid the pitfalls of dieting. This is also intended to help you understand why you're eating the way you are. And it's also intended to help ensure that your eating practices are not masked in some type of religious undertones that sort of like can sort of bubble up as almost a reincarnation of religious practice through the way that you eat or with the way that you don't eat. Just to be able to make sure that we're exploring that so that you have the highest chance of being able to be at peace with food in your body. But this is not intended to be a blanket condemnation of dietary or religious practices. And it's not intended to offend anyone's dearly held religious beliefs. And by religious beliefs, I kind of mean that very broadly. Like, if you're in this room and you're vegan, I kind of count that in here, and you'll see why. And I'm not trying to dog or bash any way of eating, okay? I'm just saying that outright. So here's where we're going to go with the presentation. We're going to spend the first section talking about the myth of dieting. And then I'm going to dive into the similarities between dieting and religion. I think that's going to be really interesting because it was super interesting to me as I was looking into this and having this on my mind and researching this. And then the third is how to break free from dieting dogma in the Mormon context. Okay? So the myth of dieting. I have a little video for you. Who loves friends? So these are the stages of dieting. Just roll with it. It's not scientific, but it's... Oh, dang it. Okay.
Working, we're moving, we're in the zone, we're grooving.
Yeah, we think that chocolate is even better than chocolate.
Right? wait, more! Oh, this is what evil must taste like.
Any cakes or cookies or something? No, Will, no. Screw it. Bring on the yams.
Will, but you've worked so hard.
And... Yams!
Okay. Sure you want to eat that?
I'm curvy, and I like it. Well, just a tiny little... Uh-oh. I'm not even sorry.
Okay. That just cracked me up when I saw that. And I feel like if you've ever dieted, you probably resonate with that. Okay, so in true Mormon fashion, we're going to start off with some definitions from Webster's dictionary. Actually, Wikipedia, because I was too lazy to look up Webster's. But so the word diet is a tricky word because some people mean it one way, other people mean it another. So I'm just going to clarify what I mean here. So the way that it's really intended to be used is the first definition. It's just the way you eat, right? But the way we usually talk about dieting is more in like the context of the second or the third definition, which is a special course of food to which one restricts oneself either to lose weight or medical reasons, and then to restrict oneself to a small amount or special kinds of foods to lose weight. Okay, so we're really talking about weight loss. Again, we're talking about bodies. We're talking about bodies here. Okay. So I don't mean just the way you eat. I mean the restrictive way people eat when they're trying to lose weight or manipulate their bodies. Okay, so this is a hotly debated statistic, and just take this with a grain of salt, but depending on where you look, it's a very high percentage of diets end in weight gain and poor poorer health outcomes. Okay, so think about it like this. If you had a disease and you went to the pharmacist and they handed you over a pill and said, hey, just so you know, I'm required to say this, 95% of the time, this pill will actually make your problem worse, but go ahead and take it. Good luck, see ya. You know, who would do that? That's not ethical. But what's crazy is we are saying that you need to diet, and it's actually making problems worse. And so this is why I'm like on, and to use religious words here, I'm on a crusade, right? I'm like trying to get people to stop dieting and just take good care of themselves, because this doesn't work and it leads to poorer health outcomes. And I'm going to talk about that. So this is my conception of the dieting cycle, what I see with my clients. So typically it starts with some type of desire to lose weight. That could be your doctor, that could be your family, that could be yourself. Coming up with that idea. And typically people go on a very restrictive plan, cutting something out, following a meal plan that like doesn't leave room for your niece's birthday on Thursday night. Right? So you restrict and maybe some weight loss. I'm not arguing that diets don't produce weight loss. I'm arguing that they don't produce healthy consequences long term. So typically you restrict so much that you actually kind of jack up your metabolism. And you also, from a psychological perspective, feel really deprived. And at some point, you fall off the bandwagon. You know, typical time is, I think, around 3 weeks. That's what I see. Some people can go longer. You can go longer, typically, if it's your first diet you've ever been on. And then subsequent diets, it's like, oh, now I can only do 3 weeks. Now I can only do two. Now I can only do one meal, right? It gets less and it gets more and more difficult, and that's not because there's something wrong with you. That's because your brain learns, and it's like, oh, hell no, you are not like restricting me like that. I will not let you do that. So you fall off the bandwagon, then you feel really bad about yourself. You start telling yourself that this means I'm a total failure, I have no willpower, I'm just a loser, I'm never going to find someone to love, whatever. You tell yourself these things. And in the best case scenario, you go off the diet and just start eating normally again. But typically, people really overcompensate, kind of like a pendulum, right? Where you've pulled up this pendulum over into restriction, and then you start eating again, you give yourself permission, and you're just over here, and you're binging, and you're out of control. Well, what do you think that's a recipe for? Your metabolism slows down, you feel like a total loser, and you're binging. Hello! Weight gain and lots of mental health struggles, right? So then the diet starts again. Then the cycle starts again, right? We're just doing this and doing this. And meanwhile, we're never blaming the diet. We're never saying, wait a minute, maybe there's something wrong with my methodology. We're saying, oh, look, see, I'm a failure. I'm a loser, right? I keep like not living up to what I'm wanting to do. And you set up more boundaries, more restriction, and the cycle only gets more intense, okay? This is what I see so often. So from the outside looking in, I recognize that as a consumer, it can really feel like nutrition science recommendations are constantly changing and contradicting themselves. You know, one day it's fine to eat eggs, the next it's not, and now you've watched What the Health documentary, if you have, listen to the podcast review about it, don't watch it. It's really kind of a dumb thing. So really, I want you to know that the problem is not with the science of nutrition. The problem is with the people who misrepresent the strengths of its findings, which is what we do in the media, right? We pull out a tiny little line in a study and blow it up to mean like, this is the secret we've all been looking for. And again, when people are talking about nutrition in the media, like we're talking about bodies. And when we're talking about bodies, we're talking about worthiness and love and connection and all the things that people really want. So this is what's so tricky and sensitive about this issue, is that it's just really easy to kind of prey on vulnerable people who want that, and they think that the only way to attain that connection and feelings of worthiness and love is through altering or manipulating their body. And that's just a lie. It's a lie. Oh, can I just make this point really quick? Time and time again, eating in moderation, which is actually a Platonic dietary pattern, has been what's shown in the research as just the common sense recommendation. Like, you don't need to do anything crazy. Just be reasonable. Just have common sense. Pay attention to your body. Learn to listen to it. And I'm going to talk more about that at the end. Thousands of years of science have added virtually nothing that stands up to rigorous scrutiny. So whenever you're hearing, you know, a dietary headline in the news, I would just encourage you to say, wait a minute, let's take that with a grain of salt. Let's think that through. You know, in the grand scheme of things, is, you know, is an egg or two in a day a big deal? Like, no, it's not. And I don't know why I'm talking about eggs, but they're just on the mind today. So this is actually a tale as old as time. There were Taoist monks in ancient China who recommended that their adherents would cut out the five grains. And I'm not sure what the five grains are, but the five grains, promising perfect health, eternal youth, immortality, and the ability to teleport, right? So those are some pretty sweet promises. So this is not new that, like, that we're having these incredible, miraculous claims coming from health gurus. It's fascinating if you look at religions. There's always some type of food rule, guideline, law, whatever you want to call it. Judaism, there's kosher, and Hinduism encourages vegetarianism. And then obviously in Mormonism, the word of wisdom serves to keep us a peculiar people. Some people have argued that as sort of the function of what the word of wisdom does. And LDS.org says the word of wisdom is the law of health revealed by the Lord for the physical and spiritual benefits of his children. He's also promised health, protection, knowledge, and wisdom to those who obey the word of wisdom. So there's dietary rules, and then there's promises, right? Which, you know, those promises aren't quite as intense as like flying and teleporting, but yeah, like special health. Go ahead. Yeah, totally. We're going to talk about that. Yep. Okay, so this is a fascinating experiment done by Michael Oakes, who's a psychologist who examined the perceptions that we have about foods. And he basically came up with this idea of the health halo effect. What he did was he showed people a mini Snickers bar this big, 47 calories, and then a picture of a giant buffet full of like cottage cheese and fruit. Okay, and he said, which one will make you fat? And I'm using the word fat just because that's what we all understand. It's a descriptor, not intended to be a pejorative. And the results were that people time and time again said Snickers bars. That amount of a Snickers bar will create that result in my body, not the 569 calories of cottage cheese and fruit. So we do have this idea of like certain foods are good, certain foods are bad, and it doesn't almost matter what quantities. We don't think about that. We just kind of think in terms of those really easy categorizations. And so that's something to be aware of, is we really do have this health halo effect around food. It's actually not helpful and not scientific. So I love this quote by Alan Levinovitz. He says, "We are vigilant over what goes into our mouths at the cost of vigilance over what goes into our minds, shunning junk food while binging on bad science," right? So this is actually like a very good way of describing how I approach nutrition. I for sure think it's important. Like, of course, I've devoted my life and my career to it, but we can't do that at the cost of having an absolutely insane, crazy thing going on in our brain. That's not helpful to us, and that's not healthy, right? If we're pursuing health, we need to keep our mental health in mind as well. So there's this really fascinating concept to understand that happens in the science of nutrition, is this idea of the nocebo effect. So you guys have heard of the placebo effect. Well, this is where the placebo effect happens, but in reverse. So this is documented when patients are receiving sham pills and they report negative side effects, even though the pills should not produce those side effects, right? So the expectation, oh, I'm taking a pill that will make me sick, actually creates sickness inside of the body, or feelings of sickness or stomach ache or whatever it might be. So this is a really important consideration to keep in mind when doing research on food allergies and food intolerances, is, you know, the feeling like, okay, I just had it because I'm up in front of all these people and I've been preparing this presentation. You know that feeling in your body that's just like, oh, this is not right. I feel like I might vomit, or like I need to run to the bathroom. Like, it's not fun. And you can have that with any food if you're nervous about it. Of course you will. So all of this propaganda, for lack of a better word, around the evilness of certain foods is actually creating a lot of really bad negative health effects in us. This is not to say that food allergies and food intolerances don't exist. they do. But this is just something to keep in mind. There's actually documented in a 2009 study of lactose. There are 54 patients who had documented lactose intolerance. Like, this was a real thing in them. And the researchers gave them sugar pills, telling them that it was full of lactose, and 14 out of the 54 reported feeling sick after eating the sugar pills, right? So this is a really powerful psychological thing that goes along with food, and it's something to keep in mind when we are trying to self-diagnose food intolerances or food allergies, et cetera. Okay, so you guys might be wondering, like, why does this chick care so much about this? Why is she on this crusade? Why is she talking about this? Well, dieting doesn't work, and it can actually be really dangerous. And just take me for my word on that. Like, I sit across the table from my clients every day, and I just get so angry at the lies that they're told about dieting. And I'm all for health. I'm all for taking good care of ourselves. But I'm not all for the way that our culture frames all of that. Dieting in the research is actually associated with an increased risk for binge eating, eating disorders, and long-term weight gain, right? So that's that 95% number that I showed you in the beginning. Like, it just doesn't work. We're surrounded by all kinds of messages about what to eat and how it will transform your bodies. And like I said earlier, this is really preying on vulnerable people who want to learn how to be healthy, or who want to make some changes in their lives, or who, you know, feel like the only way that they can have love and affection and worthiness and connection with people is through attaining some type of different body shape. And really, dieting doesn't lead to healthier living. Like, that's just plain and simple. It just doesn't. Okay, so this is really, I think, super interesting stuff. I hope you guys do too. So there are so many parallels between religion and dieting that I just want to point out. Okay, and for the true believer, the myth will always be more sacred than the evidence. Whoa. To me, like, when you think about that with dieting, there's so many dieting myths. There's so much being, you know, tossed around as fact in the nutrition and dieting world. And it doesn't matter how much you show the science. For a true believer in dieting, there's not anything you can say. And so I actually really like having this perspective that dieting is kind of like religion, because as I'm talking with my clients, we're not arguing facts, we're arguing faith, right? And like, you can't do that. You have to run with where the person is. And so that's an important thing to keep in mind as you're talking with your families and as you're discussing, you know, the niece who's vegan and the brother who's going gluten-free for no reason, right? Just recognize, okay, like, this is more of a religious pursuit than it is necessarily based on fact, so I can't really argue this with fact. Okay, so look at this. Halos, we have sinless chocolate, we have lesser evil chips, we have devil's food cake, angel's food cake, halo top. 280 calories for a pint? I haven't tried this because I'm all for real ice cream, but people say, like, is it amazing? People say it is. And you know what? I've also heard from some people that it actually causes mad diarrhea because they put a lot of fake sugar in there, which can cause a lot of water to rush into your intestines to kind of balance out the osmosis situation in there. Diffusion, right? High school biology. Okay, Ezekiel bread, enlightened cookie crunch, oatmeal cookie, wait, what? Yeah. Anyway, the perfect bar, guiltless gourmet, right? So when you start just like noticing how many religious undertones marketers use with food, it's fascinating. Then you have to ask yourself, why? Why do they say guiltless gourmet? Why do they say Ezekiel? Why do they say enlightened? Well, it's because like Ezekiel bread makes you think, oh, people were eating this way back when. Okay, that gives me peace of mind. Or guiltless gourmet. Okay, I don't have to have the uncomfortable experience of feeling guilty about eating chips, so I can eat these. And guilt and religion tend to kind of sometimes go together for people. Are you with me on that? Okay. So in the subtitle of this presentation, I talk about the increasingly secular society. I'm sure you guys are familiar with this, but just in case you aren't, religious nuns actually make up around 23% of the U.S. adult population, which if you look at that graph, it's a sharp spike from 2007 to 2014. So dieting This is sort of what I'm arguing. Dieting offers similar comforts and answers as religion. It answers questions of a very messy and complicated world, right? We want to put things into like good and bad categories and right and wrong and shoulds and shouldn'ts. But I think most of us have realized like, oh gosh, that's really oversimplifying things so many times. Dieting often offers a somewhat of an assurance of salvation through avoiding premature death, right? It also provides a community and a group to belong to, right? If you're a vegan, you're like part of the club. Like, hey, I get you. We trust each other. Like, we're on the same page with each other, right? There's like an element of belonging when you eat the same way as another person. It's a very intimate thing to eat with someone. And when you're eating different things, there's like a level of weird tension that goes on sometimes. Anyway, it also potentially gives a sense of superiority and self-mastery. I can't tell you how many people report to me how, you know, you feel a sense of like, oh, I'm stronger and smarter and kind of above that person because I eat this way and they eat that way. I'm the enlightened eater. They're the non-enlightened eater. So my question is, are we embracing dieting instead of religion? Well, okay. We all know that religion is characterized by a lot of things, but specifically there's symbols, there's rituals, there's beliefs. And if we break those down with dieting, they're there, right? So symbols, thin women, muscular men, measuring cups, food scales, scale, tape measure. Side note, I had a client who brought a food scale to Thanksgiving dinner. No. Ex-nay on the food scale thing. That's ridiculous. Okay, we have rituals. There's cleansing, there's detoxing, there's emotional eating, binging, recommitting, dieting, grocery shopping, looking online for recipes, following health gurus with all the answers, right? We do some of these rituals that give us peace of mind in this semi-religious pursuit of dieting. And then there's lots and lots of beliefs to unpack within dieting, right? The beliefs of, if I eat this, then I will get this result. This food is inherently evil or bad for me. This food is good for me. I will live forever if I follow this way of eating, right? We do this sort of subconsciously because it's just infused in our culture and in our environment. I just want to make the point, like, as if any of these things will actually bring us what we're looking for, which is belonging, worthiness, connection, and love. Like, no, that's not it. We're like pursuing these deeper things through stuff that's just never going to fulfill that. And that's why people can develop eating disorders, right? Where maybe they reach their goal with their weight and it's still, they're like, wait, where's that worthiness? Where's that love? Where's that good feeling I thought I'd get when I got to this weight? And they realize, oh, I'm not there yet. I need to keep going. Next thing you know, it's spiraled out of control and they're in a really bad space, you know? Okay, so why do we do this? This can help define your membership in a superior group. Rigid food rules also create an identity and sense of importance. Once that identity is adopted, it can be really difficult to walk away from because it becomes part of you, just like a religious identity as well. In religion, strict nutrition rules serve to create an archetypal myth of a path to salvation and purity, which is really, really fascinating parallel, if you really kind of think about that for a minute. It's in every single religion, there's food rules. I actually made a friend from a polygamist sect here in Salt Lake City, and she was telling me about some of their food things that are fascinating. I could go into it, but I probably don't have time. But yeah, there's so much of that, and there's so many promises of salvation and purity through the way that we eat. Okay, so now I'm going to kind of go through bullet. This sort of is like a bullet point list, and then I'm going to describe each of the bullets of what are the similarities between dieting and religion. So the first is we have morality and language, right? We talk about pure foods. We talk about good versus evil. Talk about detoxing from the demons. I mean, we don't say demons, but really if you think about what a nutritional demon is, it's like probably sugar right now, right? We're demonizing that quite a bit. There's spiritual cleansing. There's dietary cleansing. Guilt is a very common word that comes up. This is fascinating. Paul Rosen, who's a psychologist, did a study with Americans and people from France. And he showed them a picture of a piece of chocolate cake and said, "What's the first word that comes to your mind?" What do you think Americans said? Guilt. What do you think French people said? Celebration, right? It's fascinating that, like, that just really shows the difference between how we approach food and how other cultures approach food. And if you take a look at French health statistics and public health issues, they're very different than ours, right? They're, even though they eat that chocolate cake and enjoy it, they're far less likely to go crazy on it because they know they can eat it again tomorrow and they're really enjoying it. And at some point when you're enjoying a food, you end up realizing, oh, I'm not enjoying this quite as much anymore. Maybe it's time to stop, right? Another similarity in the morality language is this idea of, like, if you quit that diet, you're lazy, you lacked willpower. Anyone ever heard that or felt that in other ways? Okay, there's some formulaic thinking going on as well. So if I do A, B, and C, I will get results Z, right? There's that going on with nutrition, as if your body is, like, robotic and it's that easy to predict what this very complex thing will do as a result of you altering a few behaviors. You blame yourself when the formula doesn't work. Does that sound familiar for anyone in religion? Which is only reinforcing the narrative of, like, I am not enough. I'm a total loser. Look at me. I can't follow through with these things. Then there's this really fascinating kind of, what's the word? I can't think of it, but just, like, false way of thinking, where we say you are what you eat. So I told you about the protein guy yesterday. You know, he was like, hey, what do you think about protein? And it was because he, I'm pretty sure, has this idea that, like, protein, eating a lot of protein directly leads to building a lot of muscle. We could go into that. And yes, protein is needed for muscle growth, but probably not to the extent that your neighbor who's a personal trainer or gym rat will tell you. This other idea of that fat makes you fat, it's a really big bummer that it's the same word, right? It's a bummer that we call dietary fat and fat on our bodies the same thing, because metabolically that's not what's going on. And so it's just a fascinating kind of oversimplification and formulaic thinking that's going on with nutrition so often. There's also a very fascinating sort of and if any of you are in, like, the Instagram culture of nutrition, I don't know if you are, but if you are, just think about this. There's all these gurus that are sort of offering the same charismatic hope for, like, a cure, for salvation, for answers. You know, every other doctor has told you, like, I don't know, but I know the truth. And that's this really similar thing that we do, we meaning not me, but people do in this world to kind of take advantage of people. And it's, again, an effort to simplify a very messy and complicated world, which I can't blame us for. Life is really messy and complicated, and sometimes we just want some easy answers. I'm just here to stretch your mind and help you recognize, like, nutrition, it's not easy, and it's not, I mean, it is, it's pretty simple. We don't need to overthink it, but it's not just, like, an easy button. This is really interesting, too, to me, that there's this idea of, like, a savior complex, where, I'll give you some examples here. So, dictating dietary rules actually used to be a role that was previously reserved only for priests. And now that sort of anyone can kind of take on that role as the guru, it can contribute to a little bit of the savior complex. So, okay, I'm getting a little nitty gritty, but I think you guys want it. So, sodium as a nutrient. There is literally no scientific evidence to back up the 2,300 milligram recommendation we have. Do you want to know what we, on average, consume? Like, just the, like, me, how many milligrams of sodium in a day? Around 6,000. And you know what? There's actually stricter rules for some people with heart disease. They say 1,500 to 2,300. You literally cannot do that unless you have an eating disorder, unless you are barely eating any food. Okay? Hello? Issues? Yeah. But the American Heart Association and the Center for Disease Control, why won't they admit uncertainty on this? Well, it's because if they do, they're risking people not taking any of their other recommendations seriously, right? Does that sound familiar? It does to me. Diet gurus often often ignore the potential harmfulness of their advice. There's mental, there's physical harm that can be done to a person who just doesn't measure up, right? These are the people that I'm working with. I'm like cleaning up the personal trainer's messes, honestly. So I get a little fired up about this because it can be really frustrating. Go ahead. Because you have a legitimate reason. Makes everyone not take you seriously.
Exactly.
Yep.
I'll go to restaurants and be like, is this gluten-free? And they're like, oh, it has no preservatives. It's totally healthy. Cool. Is it going to make my intestines like eat themselves?
Yeah. No, good point. Really important. That'll fire me up too, because I have my people who have legitimate things that they need to not eat for their life or for their health, right? And yeah, all these people just being like, oh, gluten-free sounds cool, do that, and then help me not eat brownies. Like, super annoying. I hear ya. So then there's also this other idea of like, wait, what about the people who do measure up and they do follow the diet guru? Well, there's mental harm, because in order to measure up, you have to adopt sort of a cultish mentality to do so, right? How many of you ever been on a diet and someone invites you out to dinner and you're like, nope, can't go, can't be social, can't go to that party, can't hang out with people? Hello? If we're talking about health, we need to keep that in mind too. That's so important. Social engagements, connections with other people, like what matters more, right? Ugh, okay, I'm getting fired up. I always do. So a little bit more about salt. This is in a March 2013, a study concluded that a food pattern modeling showed that the 2010 dietary guidelines for sodium and potassium cannot be met simultaneously. You literally cannot do it. Like, if you're getting enough potassium, which is an essential electrolyte to help keep your cells and electrical impulses in your body working properly, you cannot meet both of them at the same time, right? Hello, that's dangerous and that's scary. And what about the people with the personality who are like, I'm logging everything in, I'm trying to be a good student, I want 100% with all my nutrients, and they're like, gosh, I keep falling short no matter how hard I try. For those people who are just ultra gung-ho and try really hard and have good intentions, it can really mess you up. So just a little point. Salt enhances flavor. It's okay to eat a little salt, okay? All right. Another similarity is that we really wrap our identities around both. And I'm going to talk at the end a little bit about how we can move away from that in this context. These food rules can create a sense of importance and community, like I've already talked about. And the way we eat can really become a part of who we are or who we see ourselves as. And I just want to point out that there's real dangers in mixing identities with ideas or practices, right? Like, sometimes we have to do the work of figuring out who we really are so that we can walk away from this, but that's work that's worth doing so that you're not wrapping up who you are in the way that you eat. There's a whole lot more to you than whether or not you eat potatoes. Okay. This is super interesting too. So there's demons in the nutrition world, and they're always changing, right? When I was growing up, it was fat. My mom would, you know, put fat-free sour cream on my taco. And now looking back, I'm like, what is fat-free sour cream? What is cream? It's fat. So what is fat-free fat? I don't know, something weird. And I discovered real sour cream, and I was like, whoa, that's a difference, and that's way yummier. Anyway, it's always changing. Right now, it's kind of sugar. Would you guys agree? Are you hearing that? Are you feeling that, sugar? Okay. And I'm not all for eating bunches of sugar, right? But I'm all not for eating too many carrots either, or like too many artichokes, or, you know, like, yeah, like too much of anything is not great. Sugar happens to be a whole lot easier to overeat than carrots. But, okay, so in religion, the demon in Christianity would be Satan. Listen to this. So sugar, health gurus will warn their followers, and they'll say, just so you know, sugar is known by 50 different names. You need to learn every single one of those names so that you can read your food labels and just not eat an ounce of sugar. Satan, according to biblical scholars, I'm not one of them, but I've surmised around 40 different names Satan is known by in the Bible, which I think is fascinating, right? Sugar is known by more names, so that must be even more evil. So one of the similarities is we as human beings kind of feel like we want to be told what to do. But the interesting thing is we really don't want to be told what to do. We just kind of think we do. Because we always rebel against what we're told to do. And it's the funny little part of dieting too is, oh, give me a meal plan. And then they don't eat a single thing on the meal plan. They just like wanted it for their heart, you know? Anyway, so the desire to be purified and saved from the disease and death does create a demand for answers, right? And it creates a demand for answers in nutrition. It creates a demand for answers in religion. The nutrition answers often go beyond what the scientific evidence warrants. And the rules are reinforced by myths like evil corporations, paradise past. Paradise past kind of meaning like, oh, Ezekiel bread. If it's Ezekiel, then it must be good because Ezekiel, I heard that somewhere, right? Back in the day when people weren't sick. And these myths are really spread by these evangelists with really strong points of view, and they really want to get more and more people to eat the way that they do for all the reasons that we've talked about. The truth is that there's hardly ever black and white answers. So there's another similarity called the monotonic mind, meaning that we have difficulty accepting that high and low doses of something might have a different response in the body. So this is like that religious categorization of food, whether it's saying it's impure or it's immoral. It doesn't matter if you eat a bite of pork as a Jew or like eat an entire pack of bacon, like it's the same thing. It was a sin. It was bad to do that, right? So we kind of get into the habit in a religious context of forgetting that dose matters. And a good example to kind of help this hit home is, you know, when you are taking a prescribed drug from your doctor, a lot of times it's not a whole lot different from a drug that you could buy on the street, right? You're taking it in a dose that's appropriate for your condition, hopefully, if the doctor was responsible, and if you're being responsible. And same is true for nutrition. There's a time and a place for every single food, I think, right? Would you agree? Maybe not trans fats. Those are really not that great. But there's anti-sugar zealots, and I gave the example of an Orthodox Jew with a strict kosher law. And I just want to make the point that nutrition is not monotonic. It's highly dose dependent. And we just need to keep that in mind. A little bit, wait, maybe this is my next point. No, it's not. A little bit of sugar is just fine. A lot of bit of sugar is probably not. But we could say that same thing about any food, okay? So another similarity is this idea of holy text. And this might be a bit of a stretch, but I think this is pretty true. In nutrition, the holy texts are the body of scientific literature as interpreted by health gurus or the media. In religion, obviously, the Bible, the Book of Mormon, the Quran, etc. In both, the holy texts are vast and vague and highly contested, and people cherry-pick whatever data confirms their preconceived bias, right? So we do this in nutrition, we do this in religion. I don't know what to say about that other than it's a thing. You could find anything in science to back up a way you want to eat with nutrition. I mean, there's a banana diet, there's a grapefruit diet, there's a sugar diet, we could go on and on. And all of them are proven effective, right? Okay, another interesting similarity is that dieting and religion tend to kind of perpetuate the very issues they claim to solve. And I know that's like a strong thing to say. I hope that you understand the spirit of what I'm trying to get across here, is that when we pathologize normalcy and then we say, hey, here's the cure, it's perpetuating those issues because maybe it wasn't really a problem in the first place. An example with dieting is pathologizing normal biological diversity of body shape and size, okay? Some people are larger, some people are smaller. Get over it. When we pathologize the normalcy of a larger bodied person and say, hey, that means you need to manipulate your body. That means you need to go follow this plan. That means you're not good enough. That means we don't accept you and love you, whatever. We propose this cure of dieting that's actually making their problem worse, if it's maybe not even a problem in the first place. Now, I'm not here to say that every person won't lose weight with maybe taking a bit better care of themselves. I myself have lost some weight when I started to realize, hey, I'm constantly getting overly stuffed every single day. Maybe I need to take a look at that. So I'm not against weight loss. I'm just against what we do to get there most of the time. Sexuality and religion, I'm not a religious expert, but I'm just an expert in my own experience with religion. And I've observed a lot of struggles people have with their sexuality as a result of pathologizing a normal developmental thing and a normal hormonal thing in a human, right? And it creates so much shame and guilt around something that's normal and maybe not a problem in the first place, only perpetuating the issue. Does that all make sense? Okay. I just want to tell you guys the history of sugar, or the history of sugar as if it's like a thing, but just what I've learned about sugar. So this is not a new thing. It was first demonized in the 1800s when prohibitionists claimed that it was a gateway drug to alcohol. So I think it's important to understand it in that context. By the mid-19th century, children could buy candy sold at combination tobacco candy stores, and they used little kiddie slot machines to help kind of entice them with the idea of like, ooh, this is like a bad thing to do. And so we are coming from a ripe and rich history of a lot of guilt and shame and under the table secretive behaviors around sugar. And so if you're feeling highly compelled towards it, and if you struggle with it, I just think it's understandable to know that it's important to understand that that may kind of be a little bit in your DNA, and maybe that's something to look at and just something to like maybe let go a little bit and see what happens. I just want to make the point. These are my favorite cookies. I make these. They have like a little, vanilla pudding mix in it. Have you guys done that before? Delish. I just want you to know it's far less healthy for you to feel an inordinate amount of guilt and shame about eating one cookie than it is to just eat one cookie. Right? It's not that big of a deal. Eating 10 kind of is, but your body will tell you that through a really bad stomach ache. And then that's your body's effort at being like, hey, don't do that again. And that's all it needs to be. You know, it doesn't need to be drawing conclusions about who will love you and who won't or whatever. Again, it's important to take into account what we're taking into our minds as well. So Paul Rosen, we talked about him already. He's a psychologist. He speculates some really interesting things that maybe this is like our subconscious kind of puritanical genealogy coming into play. So many of our nutrition beliefs are a form of secular puritanism, which continues to inform our food taboos. So this idea of like anything that's pleasurable, including sex and sweetness, must be bad. Rigorous science really has nothing to do with it, and the puritanical fear of sinful pleasure could be a main reason dieting and religion have so many similarities. Okay, so this is where I want to talk about how to break free of dieting in the Mormon context. I argue that you can use your experience with Mormonism to help you create a healthy relationship with food in your body. But there's two ways to think about it. So the first is like if you've had... This is sort of how I originally thought of it, and I realized that there's sort of the reverse too. So most people here have had some type of religious transition or awakening or kind of opening. I don't know how to describe it. Like most people have done some really hard work to navigate a really tricky situation with their religion. Wherever you land, it doesn't matter, but you've done a lot of work. And I argue that you can use those same skills to create a healthy relationship with food in your body. But there's also the reverse. So if you're in the middle of a crazy struggle with religion and you don't know what to do and you're like, oh, I need to learn how to not care what people think. I need to be kind to myself. I need to do all these different things, but it's so overwhelming and I'm in the middle of this. Maybe take a break from that whole religious thing and maybe just work on your relationship with food and your body, because you learn the very same skills. I'm telling you, working on these things can actually help you in so many other ways, which is why I love the work that I do. Because we can use this very tangible thing of feeding yourself to teach you really kind of high-level abstract truths about life. Like, oh, when I'm kind to myself and I stop bullying myself, I actually have room in my brain to think. Oh, when I give myself a little bit of space and permission, I actually make really good decisions. I'm trustworthy. I'm a good person. Look at me. I'm rolling with it. And to just develop some of that confidence can actually create it an easier faith transition or faith awakening or religious sort of negotiation, whatever is happening in your life. That's what I'm arguing here. So I'm going to give you some tips, tips and tricks. So the first is to get comfortable with mystery. And many of you have already done that, and that's why you're here. When I was a little bit nervous about this presentation, my mom was really wise, and she said, everyone in that room is like open-minded. Like everybody wants something new to think about. And I'm like, yes, that's true. That's not my normal audience, you know? Usually I have to kind of pump people up and get people ready to open their minds. But so that was good advice. So a lot of you have done that. You really can't separate health and spirituality because you're one person, you know? We're one person, and they're the same. They're the same. And science doesn't have all the answers, but you have all the answers you need within you. This is one of my huge epiphanies that I had in my religious experience was like, wait a minute. Oh, I have the answers. Like, it's in here. And whether that's God talking to me, if that's how you want to view it, or meditating or getting in touch with yourself, like you realize like, gosh, I'm wise, I'm strong, I'm powerful, like I have the answers. And I argue that that's the same exact thing with nutrition. You have the answers, you know what you need to do. You just need to get out of your own way and listen. But get comfortable with not having all of the answers all at once. Another important thing is to separate your personal identity from the food that you eat. That's a really, really important thing that I've already kind of talked about quite a bit. Many of you have done this with religion, decided like, okay, yeah, I'm a Mormon, but I'm also these other things. Or maybe I'm not a Mormon anymore, but that doesn't need to be an important part of my identity, right? A lot of us have done this work. You aren't what you eat. You're who you are. So some problems with identity, and this has actually been a theme I've been hearing at Sunstone. I'm sure you, if you've gone to similar sessions as me, maybe this has come up for you. When someone rejects something that is part of your identity, you take it personally, right? How many of you have experienced that with family, with religion, right? It's very easy to take it very personally when someone rejects something that is part of your identity. When you're able to separate that, and you're able to say, well, I'm not what I eat, I'm all these other things, it doesn't hurt your feelings when someone decides, hey, I'm not going to be vegan anymore. It's like, cool, good for you. Who cares, right? So this is just an important thing to kind of tease apart. Any time you align your identity with an outside person, practice, etc., you run into the risk of being offended, outraged, etc., if they make a different choice. So I really think that it's crucial to separate the two. Labels are problematic, like I am a vegetarian, I am a paleo person, whatever they call themselves. You set yourself up for whoever doesn't align with that label is automatically an adversary. And we see that in religion, right? Like, I'm a Mormon, and if you're not, ooh, I'm automatically scared of you. It doesn't need to be that way. Keeping ideas and philosophies separate from identities, I think, is an important thing that, again, if you're struggling with religion, maybe you can work on that with food and start there, and then maybe you can use those same skills to work on it with religion. Okay. Media literacy is so important for nutrition because there's so much wacko, crazy stuff out there. So just my first hint and tip is like just be really careful with what you click on Facebook. First step, right? If you click on like a dieting thing, it says, ooh, she's into dieting. We're going to send her all the advertisements and it's just going to bombard you, right? So if you're actually legitimately interested in maybe something that pops up, maybe copy and paste, type in. I mean, just don't click on it because it will learn and it will send you more and it will send you crazier stuff. Also, don't be afraid to just unfollow or hide ads or people that you find, oh, gosh, that's so gimmicky and annoying. Like, that's okay. That's okay to just say, nope, that's not my thing. And just pay attention to how you feel. If you're feeling like icky from someone's ad or article or whatever on or comments on a social media post, like you don't have to follow that person anymore. And what you see day in, day out will make a big difference in how you eat. Okay, I think Mormons in particular have a hard time with this because as a Mormon woman, I don't identify anymore as Mormon, but I'm just sort of trying to be in this space with us all here. I felt like in some ways, like I was a body, you know, like, well, you make babies, you teach them, they grow up, make more babies, and it's just like bodies, bodies, bodies. And my clients who come in, who are Mormon, often just struggle so much with understanding that they're more than that, right? That, yeah, their body is the way that they live life, but they're also a lot more than a body. Sometimes the Mormon experience can reduce people down to bodies. Thank you. And just do the work to discover like what you are beyond your body. And I can't tell you how much a person who just knows that they're more than a body is so attractive. Like, so attractive and so fun to be around and so great. And no matter how great someone's body is, when they're all weird and insecure and like uncomfortable about it, no one wants to hang out with that person, you know? And I just think that that's an important thing to keep in mind. It's not all about bodies, but we do that in the marketing of trying to sell people things. So there's a really interesting feminist perspective on this. Some argue that dieting and the obsession with thinness may be a vehicle through which women seek the kind of power and visibility that has historically been the prerogative of men. And the pursuit of thinness resurrects the dynamics of patriarchal religion, where a woman's salvation is tied to her sacrifice and obedience to the dominant social norms. So from another way to say this is like putting up a giant middle finger to the patriarchy if you just learn to love yourself, honestly, men and women, because we all have those pressures. You not spending all of your time and energy on what you eat and how you look is like creates time and space to do the things in life that matters. All or nothing thinking is programmed into us from a very young age in the Mormon context, right? So you're either in or you're out. You're either right or you're wrong. You're either good or you're bad. And that with food sets you up for so much craziness, right? So many cycles and things that just aren't helpful. Oh, I ate a bite of chocolate cake, so I might as well eat the whole thing. Where's the logic in that? But that's what we do sometimes. So recognize when you're doing that, question it, and really try to just like get rid of that. Get comfortable with the messy space. And again, a lot of you have already done that. That's why you're here. But do that with food too. Trust yourself. Most of us in this room have fought really hard to have the right to our own authority. And I think that that's sacred and special and beautiful. And don't give it away to some health guru. Put yourself below someone in the name of some type of body or way of eating. Nope, don't do it. Don't ever do that again. And just the idea of authenticity, like you're allowed to have a different body shape than someone else. That's okay. And being kind to yourself is actually one of the most important things that you'll hear me say today. We know that bullying doesn't work with our kids. We know that bullying doesn't work in schools. But why do we assume it will work on ourselves? Like, why do we bully ourselves? Maybe just try being kind and having compassion for yourself and notice how clear and easy it becomes to make choices that are in your best interest. Again, a skill that if you learn it with food, you can learn it in other ways too. So I just want to make some nutrition conclusions. I'm sorry, I was trying to leave room for questions, but I'm doing a bad job with that. We really miss the point when we hash out controversial details about nutrients and food ratios and ideal ways to eat. Learning to love your body and not trying to manipulate it through diets, I think, is a really radical act of self-care. And eating in a well-balanced, nutritious, satisfying way is also a radical act of self-care. And just to tie this into the theme of Sunstone, when we become better at taking care of ourselves, we can then have the time and energy to care and fight for the least of these, right? We have more time and energy to do the things in life that matter when we're not so wrapped up in what we're eating and how much we weigh. So there's another way. You do not have to diet, but you can take really good care of yourself. And I just want to show you, like, there's this dieting approach to health that says there's good food, bad food. Be motivated because I'm the health guru. Follow the rules. Eating is either moral or immoral. You're trying to control weight. You have a target idea of where you want to be, and you're manipulating with exercise. Well, this non-diet approach, which is the way that I approach my clients, is all foods fit. Find motivation within yourself because you're your own guru. Focus your eating on your values rather than rules, and respond to your bodily cues of hunger and fullness. There's moral neutrality with eating, meaning food isn't good and food isn't bad. It just is. There's body trust and set point theory. There's biological diversity in terms of body size, and there's joyful movement. So again, use what you've learned with your journey with religion to hone in on a place of great, of gently taking care of yourself in a way that's right for you. So that's it. And I finished right on time, so no questions. Thanks.